You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and thank you for joining The American Revolution. This week, episode 305, The Siege of Menorca. Now this week, we're stepping away from North America to look at the battle raging over in Europe. By 1781, the British were so short-handed in America because of the war with France and Spain. Both countries were taking real estate back from Britain, believing that their traditional enemy was spread too thin due to the American Rebellion, and that other colonies and territories around the world were vulnerable to attack. The main reason Spain did get involved in the war was over the hope of retaking Gibraltar, part of the Spanish mainland that had been under British control for over 70 years by that time. A combined British and Dutch force captured the region in 1704 during the War of Spanish Succession, and the island remained a British possession in the treaty that ended that war. In the decades following the capture, Britain viewed its control of Gibraltar as more of a bargaining chip to use against Spain. There were several proposals to return Gibraltar to Spain over the years, but the two countries could never come to terms. Spain had attempted to retake Gibraltar militarily multiple times since then, but without any luck. So, almost as soon as Spain declared war on Britain in 1779, it began a siege of Gibraltar. But after 2 years, that siege seemed to be going nowhere. Spanish officials decided they might want to focus on some other British possessions in the area that might be vulnerable, and attention quickly turned to Menorca. The island of Menorca sits in the Mediterranean. It's about 130 miles southwest of Barcelona. It's the second largest of a chain of islands that had for centuries been controlled by Spain or other Spanish kingdoms before Spain became a unified nation. Britain had taken control of Menorca in the same peace treaty that gave it control of Gibraltar. Menorca became an important naval base for British ships in the Mediterranean. The British moved the capital to Port Mahon and established a naval base there. The British also built up a Spanish fort there, which had been known as the Castillo de San Felipe, and which the British called Fort St. Philip. During the Seven Years' War, a French fleet took back Menorca from the British. At the outset of the war, France deployed a 16,000-man army and 17 ships of the line to dislodge the British. French forces were able to take the island rather easily, but had to besiege the British garrison at Fort St. Philip. That siege lasted about 2 months before the British garrison finally surrendered. The British, with less than 3,000 men, had managed to hold off the French, losing only a few dozen killed and a few more wounded. The French losses were over 3,600 dead and wounded, although many of those deaths came from disease rather than actual battle. Now, during the siege, Britain had sent a relief fleet under Admiral John Byng, which attacked and withdrew rather quickly. During a review after the battle, a court-martial determined that Admiral Byng had failed to do his utmost to relieve the British garrison and ordered him executed by firing squad. Although many thought the admiral would receive clemency, he did not, and he was shot the following spring. Without that British naval support, the British garrison could not get food and supplies and began to starve. So, even though their defenses were holding, the British agreed to surrender, and they did so under the promise that they would be sent back to Gibraltar. France held the island for the remainder of the Seven Years' War. Then, in 1763, the peace treaty that ended the war returned Menorca to British control. In exchange, Britain returned the captured island of Guadeloupe to France. For the Spanish, British control of Menorca, part of a chain of Spanish islands, was almost as galling as British control of Gibraltar. During the most recent war, Britain had made Minorca a port for British privateers who attacked French and Spanish shipping in the region. So Spain set its sights on retaking the island and requested support from its ally in the French Navy. During the summer of 1781, Spain deployed an invasion fleet, which included 51 troop carriers moving 13,000 soldiers. The fleet was backed by supply ships, hospital ships, bombardment ships, and 13 Navy vessels. Don Luis Berton de los Blats, the Duc de Crillon, commanded the fleet. Crillon was a French army officer from an aristocratic family, who rose to the rank of general after fighting in the War of Austrian Succession and the Seven Years' War. And near the end of the Seven Years' War, he moved to Spain and took a commission as a general in the Spanish army. Spain and France were close allies and both ruled by the Bourbon family during this era, so I guess changing armies didn't seem to raise a lot of eyebrows. Crillon had been part of the Spanish effort to recapture Gibraltar after Spain declared war on Britain in 1779. While that siege continued without him, the king tasked him with the capture of Minorca in 1781. France deployed 20 more ships of the line under the command of Admiral Luc Herbain du Boxic, the Comte de Guichen, to support the Spanish fleet. Like his counterpart, Guichen was also an experienced officer from a noble family. He'd also fought in the War of Austrian Succession and the Seven Years' War. Guichen had fought at the Battle of Ushant and also in the West Indies, where the Comte de Grasse had served under him. In the summer of 1780, Guichen led a merchant fleet back to Europe, leaving de Grasse in charge in the West Indies. So both France and Spain were sending two of their most experienced admirals to lead this campaign. Both fleets approached Minorca, hoping to surprise the British there. The French fleet had initially headed out to the Atlantic, hoping to fool anyone who was watching that it was headed to America. It then slipped past Gibraltar at night, avoiding observation as it entered the Mediterranean. Although France had provided this naval support, the invasion itself was a Spanish operation. The Spanish planned to land its main army at Mosquito Bay, just north of the capital at Port Mahon. A smaller force would land south of the capital. The hope was to march both armies at once and capture most of the British garrison outside of the fort. The fleets arrived at Minorca in late August of 1781. Plans began to fall apart almost immediately. British observers spotted the fleets on the southern side of the island and sent urgent dispatches to Port Mahon. Within hours, most of the garrison was in the fort. The defenders also put a chain across the mouth of the port and sank several ships there to prevent an invasion fleet from entering. Now, despite getting its defenses in place in time, the British did face a pretty difficult situation. The British commander, James Murray, was also a highly experienced officer from an aristocratic family. Like his opponents, Murray was old enough to have fought in the War of Austrian Succession, where he served as a captain in a grenadier company. After the war, Murray used his experience and family money to purchase a commission as a major and then as a lieutenant colonel. He had faced off against de Guichen during the Seven Years' War when the latter besieged Louisbourg in Canada. Now, I've talked about Murray's service very early in this podcast. He was one of three generals under General Wolfe during the capture of Quebec in 1759. After the war, Murray received promotion to Major General and served as the British governor of Quebec from 1763 to 1768. After his return to Britain, Murray received an appointment as Lieutenant Governor of Minorca in 1774, and then as governor in 1778. Murray's lieutenant governor was also a general in the regular army, William Draper. There's some debate about the size of the British garrison. Some contemporary reports say the defenders numbered around 5,600. However, nearly 2,000 of those were civilian workers and local militia. Many of the locals were from other nationalities. There were sizable Jewish, Greek, and North African communities living on the island, and it appears that few, if any, of these mustered at the fort for its defense. Within a few weeks of its invasion, Spain expelled all of these communities, removing them from the island. some of the British regulars that had been stationed at Menorca before the war had deployed to North America. To replace them and keep up the garrison's numbers, George III had deployed soldiers from Hanover in what is today Germany to fill the garrison at Menorca. Recall that, in addition to being King of Britain, George was also the Elector of Hanover. Murray reported having about 2,700 men, of which about 2,000 were British regulars, although he also noted that 400 of his regulars were invalids who could perform limited service. And despite the disparity in forces, Fort St. Philip was a pretty formidable defense. The Spanish forces would be unable to take it by simply storming its defenses. Instead, both sides settled in for a siege. General Murray managed to get a message off the island via a Venetian merchant vessel, which brought word to the British consulate at Florence that the garrison was under siege. Even so, there were no British fleets readily available to help break the siege. Initially, Spanish forces deployed just over 10,000 soldiers to the island. The Spanish army set up an artillery battery on Cape Mollal, just across from Port Mahon, to the west of Fort St. Philip. Over time, they set up additional artillery batteries on the north, west, and south of the fort, so that attackers could effectively fire on the fort from all sides. After several months, the Spanish received reinforcements, increasing their ranks to over 13,000, and the addition of some French soldiers may have put the enemy boots on the ground at over 16,000. By November, the Spanish were lobbing mortar shells into the fort, causing some damage, but not enough to actually take the fort. During this period, the British defenders weren't simply hunkering down. British cannons fired on the Spanish artillery, destroying some of them. Several British sorties from the fort killed or captured enemies who got too close. However, given the vast difference in force size, these British sorties had to retreat back into the fort before the Spanish could mount any sort of counterattack. Now, several months into the siege, Spanish officials put Crillon under pressure to see if they could just finish off the garrison. The Spanish general had a reputation as a courteous enemy who was gracious to his opponents. There's an example of this in a story during the siege at Gibraltar. Crillon had sent the British commander a shipment of fresh fruits and vegetables and meat, as well as some ice, noting the excessive heat, and included a note saying he looked forward to becoming his friend after facing him as an enemy. On Menorca, about 2 months into the siege, Crillon attempted to reach out to Murray in hopes of ending the siege as soon as possible. Crillon decided that the way to cut this thing short was maybe just to offer a bribe. In mid-October, he offered Murray a payment of what amounted to a little more than £100,000 and a general's commission in the French or Spanish army if Murray would surrender the fort. Murray, understandably, took the offer as an insult to his honor. The two leaders exchanged a series of notes that indicated that there would be no surrender anytime soon. The British had plenty of ammunition, impenetrable defenses, and enough food to last for a year before the need for a relief fleet. Now, soon after this exchange, a dispute broke out between General Murray and his second-in-command, General Draper. It seems that Draper began to favor a British surrender in late October. The timing of this has led some historians to speculate that the Spanish might have offered a bribe to Draper after Murray had turned down such an offer. Now, there's no actual evidence of such a bribe, nothing's ever been found, but the timing does seem suspicious. During the first few months of the siege, the two generals seemed to work well with one another. However, on October 29th, Draper wrote a letter back to a member of the House of Lords stating, quote, "My lord, I am sorry to be obliged to inform you that I think Lieutenant General Murray, in his capacity as magistrate, has acted so very ill that I hold it incumbent upon me to bring him to trial for the same, and I must beg the favor of you to inform His Majesty therewith." Now, this letter is frustratingly unclear about exactly what Murray had done to deserve being put on trial, but it's very clear that the two leaders were not getting along. A few weeks later, Murray wrote a note to Draper criticizing him for not doing his duty and asking if he wanted to be relieved. Draper continued, and the two seemed to continue working on the defense of the fort for the next couple of months. In January of 1782, when Murray ordered defenders to withdraw from some of the fort's outer works and reinforce the inner works, Draper demanded a council of war, or said he would no longer serve as lieutenant governor. Murray took that as an act of insubordination. He relieved Draper of command and divided Draper's military command between a British Colonel Pringle and a Hanoverian Colonel Linsing. In addition to commanding the defense of the fort, Murray also had to deal with dissension in the ranks caused by Draper's removal and the view of many officers that they really did need to consider surrendering. In truth, the military situation began to get much worse over November and December. Enemy mortars had destroyed many gardens inside the fort that provided the only source of fresh vegetables. As a result, many in the garrison were suffering from scurvy. Malnourishment also allowed other diseases to begin to take their toll. The garrison had fallen to about 1,500 men, many of those in hospital. Many soldiers who were sick actually refused to go to hospital, especially since there was little that could be done there, and there are actually a few accounts of guards simply dropping dead from sickness while on guard duty. The reason that Murray had to pull back from the outer defenses in January was that he no longer had enough men to defend them. The enemy had begun to intensify its bombardment in preparation for a final assault. About the same time, enemy mortars destroyed a storehouse that contained much of the salted meat that had been sustaining the garrison. The defenders managed to hold out for a few more weeks, keeping up cannon fire against the enemy. But by February, they were losing 50 men a day to scurvy. Murray noted that he needed 830 men to maintain guard duty in the fort, but only had 660 who were healthy enough to do so. Also, all of those 660 men showed signs of scurvy, meaning they would not be able to do their duty for much longer. With the end appearing near, Murray sent a note to Creon on February 4th, setting forth the terms under which he would surrender the fort. Essentially, Murray was willing to give up the fort in exchange for the passage of his men and their arms back to Gibraltar. His men would retain their arms, ammunition, and flags while awaiting transport. Creon, of course, also realized the end was near for the British and refused these generous terms. He countered that any surrender would require the British garrison to become prisoners of war. Now, the following day, the two commanders reached a compromise agreement. The British would become prisoners of war temporarily, but then would be allowed transport back to Gibraltar. Creon allowed that, quote, in consideration of the constancy and valor which General Murray and his men have shown in their brave defense, they shall be permitted to go out with their arms shouldered, drums beating, lighted matches, and colors flying, till having marched through the midst of the army, they shall lay down their arms and colors. The British force of about 950 soldiers, who were still capable of walking, walked out of the fort on February 6, 1782, to the nearby town of Georgetown, where they laid down their arms. British records report only 59 defenders killed in the battle, meaning that probably nearly 2,000 died of scurvy or other diseases during the siege. The victors did everything they could to care for their foes, providing them with much-needed food and medicine. French ships then carried the survivors back to Gibraltar. The Spanish victory made Creon a national hero. He received promotion and accolades, including changing his title to the Duc de Creon de Mahon. Spanish leaders gave him command of the Siege of Gibraltar. Over in London, the dispute between General Murray and General Draper only grew larger. Draper returned to London, while Murray remained in Gibraltar for several months. Draper, while in London, referred 29 charges against his former commander to be heard by court-martial. Now, Murray's absence, as well as the chaos in the government following the news of Yorktown, meant that the court-martial didn't have a chance to sit until the end of 1782, and did not render a verdict until early in 1783. Murray was acquitted of all but two minor charges, one of which was bringing discredit and dishonor upon Draper, and the court recommended only a reprimand. The king did not actually issue a reprimand, but basically let the court's call for a reprimand stand for itself. The court also ended up directing Draper to sign an apology to Murray for bringing frivolous and ill-founded charges against his commander. Now, the following year, the court published the records of the court-martial, including Murray's defense, but they left out Draper's response to the defense, so Draper published his own views in a public pamphlet. Not much more really came of the feud, but as a result, both of the generals had pretty much ended their military careers and went into retirement. Next week, we're going to take a look at some of the other battles around the world that pressured the British to end the war in America.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Celentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution. Be sure to check out the Sons of the American Revolution podcast at fastfunhistory.com. Thanks also to Robert Morris Circle supporter 10 Crucial Days, and you can check out their website at 10crucialdays.org. I really do appreciate everyone who helps to support this podcast, either through subscriptions on Patreon or through one-time donations via PayPal or Venmo. Your support makes this possible. I also want to remind everyone of our next roundtable. We plan to discuss current preparations around the country for the 250th anniversary. Some people like to call this the semi-quincentennial. I actually prefer the term sestercentennial. You can also use the term quarter millennial, whatever you like. It's been 250 years since the American Revolution, and it's a time to celebrate that fact. I've asked several people who have been deeply involved in the planning to join us for this roundtable discussion. The live event will take place on Zoom on April 10th, 2024. If you want an invitation, be sure to get on my mailing list at MailChimp, or just reach out to me directly for the Zoom link. Now, this week, we stepped away from North America to talk about the Spanish takeover of Menorca in the Mediterranean. It's important to remember that this broader war is what finally convinced Britain to give up on the war in North America. If France and Spain were not threatening to take British colonies around the world, Britain probably wouldn't have been in such a hurry to settle with the Americans, and almost certainly would not have offered the generous terms that they did. The British loss of Menorca came only a couple of months after officials learned of the loss at Yorktown. This 1-2 punch had a big impact on the British will to continue fighting. Not only was the war in America failing, other British outposts were also now beginning to tumble. Many leaders became convinced that it really was time to cut their losses. When Britain lost Menorca back in the Seven Years' War, it was able to recover that valuable island by trading it for another island that it had captured, Guadeloupe. This time, Britain did not get Menorca back when the war ended. It remained under Spanish control. In 1798, when Britain and Spain were at war yet again, Britain captured the island back. However, when that war ended in 1802, Britain returned Menorca to Spain. Since then, the island has remained under Spanish authority. During the Napoleonic Wars, the British Navy actually helped protect Spanish Menorca from a threatened French occupation. In 1815, the United States established its first naval base in the Mediterranean at Port Mahon in Menorca. The initial reason was part of the new U.S. Navy's effort to put down the Barbary pirates that were attacking U.S. shipping in the Mediterranean. The U.S. Navy base there closed in 1993, but the U.S. actually maintained a presence on the island until 2008. Because the Siege of Menorca ended in a Spanish victory, it seems that many of the more modern books that look at these events are written in Spanish. I was not able to find a good book in English that really covered these events in any detail, and since my Spanish is not good enough to read those books, I won't be able to recommend any of them. As a result, I'm going to go off topic for my book recommendation this week. I want to recommend a newer book called Freedom: The Enduring Importance of the American Revolution by Jack D. Warren Jr. Most of the books I recommend look at specific incidents or parts of the war. This book takes a more general look at the entire course of the war and the changes it brought to America and to the world. It was published just a few months ago by the Society of the Cincinnati, which is a veterans group that was founded after the American Revolution and which restricts memberships to descendants of officers who fought in the Continental Army. The author of this book served for many years as the executive director of the American Revolution Institute of the Society of Cincinnati. The book is a bit pricey, but it gives a good substantive overview of the revolution, along with how this era really changed definitions of freedom. It's an interesting read, so if you're looking for a more general book, consider taking a look at Freedom by Jack Warren. My online recommendation is an older book that's about the British commander at Menorca, James Murray. It's called The Life of General the Honorable James Murray by Reginald Mahone. This is a biography, and it really focuses more on Murray's time as administrator of Quebec. Normally, in the after show, I tend to write about the great things people went on to do after the war. In Murray's case, he's best known for his leadership before the revolution. His loss at Menorca is seen as kind of a sad ending to a rather successful career in the military and British government. Even so, this biography spends several chapters covering the Siege of Menorca and provides some detailed information about the events that we covered this week. The book was published in 1921, so it's in the public domain. As always, I've included direct links to the book on archive.org, and you can find those available on my blog and website. If you want to look it up yourself, again, the title is The Life of General the Honorable James Murray by Reginald Mahone. My question this week asks, where did Americans get gunpowder for the revolution? Well, especially in the early years of the war, black powder shortages were a real problem for the Americans. At the time, almost all black powder used in the colonies was imported from Britain or elsewhere in Europe. With that source cut off, the soldiers really had to scramble. Now, there were three small powder mills in America when the revolution began. Two were near Philadelphia, and a third was near Morristown, New Jersey. Once the war began, a few more opened up in New York and New England, but they really, in total, did not supply a great deal of powder. The ingredients for black powder have never been terribly hard to find. Powder is a mixture of charcoal, sulfur, and saltpeter. We would call that potassium nitrate today. Charcoal is easy enough to get from burning wood. Saltpeter is processed from decaying plants and animal manure, or even human feces for that matter. And sulfur is mined from the ground. Now, apparently the hardest ingredient to obtain at the time was the saltpeter. The extraction process was slow and difficult. The Continental Congress even printed and distributed a pamphlet on how to make it in hopes of increasing supply and offered a premium price to pay for the product. Now, despite these efforts, domestic production of black powder was woefully inadequate for the needs of the army. Part of the problem may have been that producing powder was particularly dangerous. It had a bad habit of exploding during production, which could destroy all the equipment and kill the workers. In the first 3 years of the war, it's estimated that domestic sources produced only about 50 tons of powder, meeting only a fraction of the Army's needs. Congress attempted to purchase powder abroad. Most of what they got, they bought in the West Indies, where European-produced powder could be purchased, then slipped past the British Navy guarding the American coast. Many tons of powder were also purchased directly in France and shipped across the Atlantic. In addition, General Washington equipped several ships early in the war, telling them to focus on capturing British supply ships carrying powder. French shipping provided over 500 tons of powder to the Americans in 1776 alone. About 90% of the black powder used by Americans came from overseas. Domestic production really never achieved any great success during the war. As a result, Americans were always heavily dependent on imports. And this need to import powder continued for many years after the Revolution. Eventually, French refugees from the French Revolution settled in America, and finding this domestic supply of black powder still highly inferior and expensive, the DuPont family began producing powder in Delaware. This became the first really large producer of black powder in America, but the DuPonts did not begin production until 1802, well after the Revolution ended. The DuPonts did, however, become a major supplier to the U.S. government during the War of 1812. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me either via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.
What does Sputnik have to do with student loans? How did a set of trembling hands end the Soviet Union? How did inflation kill moon bases? And how did a former president decide to run for a second non-consecutive term? These are among the topics we deal with on the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics podcast. We tell stories of history that relate to today's news events. Give a listen. My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, wherever you get podcasts.